This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Activist Tarana Burke first created the Me Too campaign a decade ago to reach sexual assault victims in underprivileged communities. But the movement saw a resurgence these last few weeks when actress Alyssa Milano urged all women who had been sexually harassed or assaulted to write Me Too as a status on social media to give the world a sense of the magnitude of the problem. What ensued, of course, was a global outpouring from people, predominantly women, sharing their own experiences of facing sexual harassment and assault. Joining me now are Shar S. Alia, Bilkis Hijaz and Lee Tree Lin to discuss their thoughts on this movement, a useful campaign that achieved its aim or merely clicktivism. Welcome, ladies. How are you today?
Great. Good, thanks for the invite.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. So just to start off with, did you ladies actually use the hashtag on your own social media platform? Maybe we can start with you, Lin.
Okay, I did, but not in the early stages. I saw it. I was quite moved by the sheer amount of it as it was showing up. But I didn't feel a particular tug until I sort of sat with my feelings for a bit, as it were, and wondered why it was that I was feeling a bit disquieted by all of it, or feeling a little, I don't know. You know, normally I think participating in things like petitions or clicktivism, as you rightly point out, it doesn't usually ping. I've signed, I don't know how many petitions in my lifetime. I don't know how many things I've added my name to and forgot about. But this felt a little different. And also I felt a bit conflicted about putting it out there, not because of privacy, or maybe it was, I don't know, but I did eventually. And I'm still not sure how I feel about it.
Okay. What about you, Bilkis?
I didn't, although I thought about it for some time, and in the end I took the somewhat cowardly excuse, I think, of being like, I'm too busy for this now and I'll get back to this later, which I never actually did. And now I think the moment has passed. But can I do it on air? Does this count? Can I say Me Too? Or is that also kind of a cop-out? I also felt very conflicted about it. It was interesting to see everybody's feeds light up with it. And I think in that way, it does sort of achieve the purpose of greater visibility for this problem. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether among women that was necessarily necessary. I think we all know that basically every woman in the world has been subject to some kind of sexual harassment at some point in their lives, or they will be if they haven't already. I didn't initially put my name to it because I felt a little irritated because I saw a lot of people responding to people who had said Me Too on Facebook with the little cry face sign. And I was like, okay, yes, it is upsetting to know that your friends and family have been harassed or assaulted. Mm-hmm. But this is not a pity fest. This is not the point of this. Yep. The point is to become more aware of the problem. And I think if you're going to have a kind of emotional response to it, your emotional response should be anger. You should be very, very angry, and you should be angry all the time. So I didn't want a pity response from other people being mm-hmm. like, oh, poor you, did something terrible happen to you? And then I also felt like it was required of me to sort of justify my position on it, what exactly had happened to me. Mm. And then I felt that, oh, I needed to say, and you know, I wasn't raped or anything. The things that have happened to me are possibly the most minor things that could happen to anybody and still be classified as sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, well, why do I have to justify that? Why do I have to come out and particularly delineate, this is exactly, it was this that happened to me and it happened on this date? And as someone else I've read said, you know, why do I have to relive the most humiliating moments of my life?
Precisely, yeah.
So I haven't so far, but not because I couldn't.
Yeah. And Shar, before we get into all of that discussion, I mean, did you put that hashtag as well?
I didn't. And it wasn't because I haven't experienced it. Again, it was very much, oh, yes, this is just all of us saying things that, you know, women already know. I think what was my first reaction was just being really overwhelmed because it was something that I had always known suddenly permeating every part of my life. And so I was listening to a lot of different friends, a lot of different colleagues, a lot of different acquaintances and even strangers share such painful stories of varying scale. And it's exactly right that if you're not raped and you experience something that's considered quote-unquote minor, it's still sexual harassment. It's still, you know, on the scale or spectrum of assault. But I think having all those stories in one space was so important, but also so draining as someone participating in it that I couldn't find my voice to say me too. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel right. It didn't feel like there. It was a space I needed specifically to say it. But I also felt very moved by seeing everyone share their stories on my social media feeds. So for me, it doesn't feel like something I need to use. But I did feel compelled to speak up on the campaign when I saw somebody diminish the the impact of it. So I saw someone online say the Me Too campaign isn't going to engender any change, so why bother with it at all? And that really got me to finally feel able to rise above my feeling of feeling overwhelmed and feeling drained by this discussion, as important as it is, as empowering as I think it is for some people, and finally speak up to say it's absolutely necessary. Yeah, in so many different ways.
And that was actually my next question. You know, do you think something like this, a hashtag, you know, or any viral moment for that matter, no matter how widespread it is, can it actually, you know, really turn into like lasting movement that will create the social change that, you know, it's, you know, wanting, right? And and actually, in this case, you know, reduce sexual abuse of women.
I've been thinking about this a lot. Well, this and all the issues surrounding it, such as why men, primarily men, some women also, who are themselves living in a world of toxic masculinity and kind of feeling those pressures and having those things shape the way they think. I've been wondering why it's so difficult for people to accept other people's experiences. And I think it's often because you feel as if it is a personal attack, even though it is never an attack. You know, it's just, well, hence you get not all men. Mm-hmm. That awful hashtag. And so I think it's useful if only to see the scale of it, which I think was the initial purpose as well, to just to witness this sort of huge widespread outpouring of Me Too and recognizing that it's not just the people who dress in a way that you think would invite it, or who post in a way that you think would invite it, or whatever, you know, it's your teachers, your aunties, your whoever, it's all Me Toos. And that I think Shah's point about it being draining was so important, because I did feel drained by that. I mean, we are living in a climate of constant bad news. And this just felt like more bad news. You know, it's telling me over and over again something that I know and have experienced and that I trusted, you know, that most people had experienced as well. But to see people responding to it, I think, has been heartening. If not to form some sort of formal coalition or to start having real change, I think just to see people going, huh. Because I think once you move people into a space of, huh, as opposed to complete defensiveness, then maybe a conversation might be more possible, more productive. But we're in early days, right?
Yeah.
But that's how it feels.
Yeah, I kind of can draw an analogy, I think, between the success or like otherwise of the Me Too movement with Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. Mm.
And the same idea that this counter hashtag of not all men is very similar to, but all lives matter. And I think the same argument applies here. Yes, all lives matter. Yes, men also are subject to abuse, but we're focusing on the abuse of women right now. And this is a very incredibly widespread problem. And so I think it deserves, I think we all think it deserves its day. I think it's obvious that this has had an enormous effect already. I mean, the reason that Alyssa Milano called for it is because it came directly out of the whole Harvey Weinstein scandal.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the fact that so many people came out and started to accuse Harvey Weinstein of rape and other forms of sexual assault emboldened a lot of other women to do the same. And then this effect, I think, has spread. A number of people have come out to accuse members of parliament in the UK of sexual assault. Someone came out and accused George Bush Sr. of sexual assault, and which he admitted to. He acknowledged the way that he had, not sexual assault, sexual harassment, the way he had behaved. So it is clear that it is having an impact, and it is creating an environment where people who have not felt strong enough before to come out and accuse people of the assault that they have experienced, this is suddenly becoming that tiny bit more possible. And I think that if that is the only good outcome, it is worth it.
Yeah. I think it's also kind of, you can't see this as the start of pressure and accountability towards people who have perpetrated sexual harassment, because you look back at the past year of the Bill Cosby trial and, you know...
the bus.
Yeah.
Donald Trump and the bus.
Yes, yeah. Trump and the bus. And, I mean, that's on such a global kind of... I mean, obviously a very much more American context. And you can see the ripples of that at the time and also now, because I think after Me Too, I started seeing open letters from women artists. I started seeing lists being distributed for New York media, for Indian academics. So it was starting to be really like regionalized, contextualized, localized, that women are trying to look out for their nearest community to say, here are the harassers in our midst. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, yeah, the most on-the-ground impact of something that starts as a hashtag, as a social media movement. And I think, yeah, that's so important. But there's a part of me that's still skeptical, because how many women came out and accused Bill Cosby? How many women have come out to accuse Trump, you know, how many people have spoken up against Woody Allen or like the million harassers in Hollywood? And it's only now, you know, Jane Fonda said something recently about the Weinstein scandal, how people are only starting to pay attention because the women that are accusing him are white and rich.
So there's
that kind of, is this movement empowering the people who still don't have access to make their voice be heard? You know, the we're talking about maybe actresses, people in high profile positions, but what about, say, the cleaner in the office or the intern that has no recourse to that? So, you know, it's kind of, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it is a movement. It has the possibility to move beyond a moment to a movement, for mm-hmm. sure. Mm-hmm. And I hope it does.
Because it's interesting, because this movement, I mean, the Me Too thing campaign started actually a decade ago, you know, and
yeah,
that was for underprivileged people.
Yeah.
But, you know, now when all these, well, very beautiful, very influential, very, you know, very well-known women came out and said it, and suddenly it became, yes, this is really a problem. I mean, what do you say? It's like we're griping over, you know, silly things like that. But it did take that sort of, you know...
Mm. Yeah,
it's the co-opting of a movement. If to go back to the analogy of Black Lives Matter, when you look at Colin Kaepernick kneeling football games to protest police brutality, and now it's become, oh no, it's a protest for free speech, and you know, oh no, it's a protest against the flag, oh no, it's a protest against the Constitution of America, and you're just like, when that dilution happens, I think it does have an impact, and you're not squabbling about small things.
And it's also a strategic method of distraction.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think it's important to keep your eye on the ball. Thinking of what you said, Cher, about moving from a moment to a movement, I think that's what I am most skeptical about with the hashtag, because you see the hashtags come and go, and then you see people sort of jump on board and get on the bandwagon, and then as soon as it turns around and this is not trendy anymore, then people forget. And I really do think that this is something we have to be angry about all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
That point about anger is so interesting, because I find myself angry all the time. And it affects so much of how I approach what I read, how I approach how I think, who the people I speak to and how I speak to them. There's so much impact in terms of my sort of global anger on my personal life.
Yeah,
and there is that weird intersection that happens. And and that's why, again, the moment to movement thing, which just has Hamilton stuck in my head. but that line, I just think that's really where we might be seeing change is in, sadly, the amount of anger. And that's more emotional labor, right? That's more emotional labor that nobody really asked for. But I think the fact that it's so constantly in your face, it keeps the fires burning, I think. And that is enough to push it a little bit further along. And eventually you're going to need different fuel. I don't think anger can sustain you without draining you. And that sort of cycle is just not going to be helpful to anybody. But in the meantime, sort of the sheer amount of stories, every time I read another story, every time I read another, you know, accusation of rape against Weinstein, for example, and you just think, well, yes, the ladies who spoke out were powerful. And yes, they took their time, but that is their right. Yeah. And at least they're using their power now in a way that is helpful to others, to people who are underprivileged. I know that there are a lot of power dynamic issues that come with that. Yeah. But in terms of intersectionality, I think this is at least a positive example of that. Mm. I mean, sure, Angelina Jolie doesn't represent some, you know, a seamstress somewhere in India, for example. Mm. But perhaps reading about her might make you think differently the next time somebody steps in and grabs her arm or, you know, touches her where she doesn't want to be touched. I don't know. Yeah.
And I think the impact of having it be these incredibly powerful women or people that we think of being very powerful, and not so much the fact that they stepped out to say something, but that it took them such a long time.
Exactly. Yeah.
That obviously, how powerful were they ever when for decades some of them have been living with this and have not been able to say anything about it or have not felt like they were in a position where they were able to be able to lose a job because they knew that if they said something about it, they'd never be hired again. So I think the importance of this is that it shows, again, not just that it happens to every woman, but that there is no position that you can hold as a woman in society that will make you immune to this.
Yeah.
I'm speaking today to Shar S. Elia, Bilkis Hijaz and Lee Tree Lin, all three feminists, and we are actually discussing the Me Too campaign. We'll continue after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today are Shar S. Elia, Bilkis Hijaz, and Lee Tree Lin, all three feminists. And we're all discussing the Me Too campaign, which was, you know, to sort of reach out to people to talk about whether they had actually faced sexual harassment or sexual assault in their lives in any way. And I mean, I was reading something by, you know, another feminist who wrote that, you know, just giving language to these sorts of things, sexual harassment and, you know, these sorts of campaigns, just empowers people to understand what is happening to them and to give them a voice to actually to understand what has happened to them. Like, you don't understand, maybe if you're a young girl, for example, that if someone touched you and, you know, you didn't feel right about it, but you didn't know what was wrong. I mean, you weren't raped, for example, but you didn't like what happened to you. So, you know, campaigns like this actually give a language to what's, you know, these sort of everyday occurrences. Yeah. Do you think that's something that has come about with this campaign as well?
You know, I read an article in New York Magazine which argued that because people don't want to talk about sex, perverts win. Because you don't want to talk about sex, because you don't have the language to describe what happened or why something made you uncomfortable, they're counting on your human decency and everybody's decency to look away, which is what we also saw with Weinstein, where the article cited, and this is true, Matt Damon saying about Gwyneth Paltrow, well, yeah, I heard about it, but she continued to work with him. So I figured it was a private matter and they sorted it out. And so there is that discomfort around someone else's sex life, especially in a professional setting, that causes you to look away and go, ah, it's probably a personal thing, it's fine. And I think that's part of the language thing. It's good to have the vocabulary, but it's also good to have the normalization of the vocabulary to get people to use these words. I mean, growing up, I think, especially in Malaysia, you just have rape and molestation. Those are the two words that come up. You know, those are the two
incest
words.
Incest now. There's, that's a great deal.
Well, that is a wonderful development.
Addition, yes.
But it doesn't always tell you what counts, you know. And then there are all these things that hover in that middle ground. What if somebody's arm, you know, it stayed on your shoulder or just a little too close to your breast, just a few seconds too long? What word is there for that? You know, that discomfort, that very specific discomfort, and you know what it means. But to say it sounds petty. To say it sounds like nobody will believe you. And so I think it's not just the language, but it's also just normalizing using the language. And in some ways, allowing people to say, I was assaulted, you know, without it having to be rape necessarily. Without, you know, you don't have to feel guilt about using that word because it wasn't as grievous as rape. It's all grievous. It's just there is a scale, but it's all grievous.
You shouldn't have to apologize for that.
Yeah.
I would hope also the conversation expanding all of our vocabularies and normalizing it, as Lynn said, would also then shift the story from it being about sex, which is what people think all the time. So, you know, a hand near to the breast is somewhat in the vicinity of sex, but a joke might not be, or kind of like a tender, like stroking of your cheek might just, oh, that's affection, you know? So if we move the conversation from sex to power, why is it that we feel uncomfortable when someone enacts these things upon us without our permission and consent, you know? So those words I would like to see more in the vocabulary, consent, power, kind of those negotiations.
Yes, I think going back on a tangent to the incest thing, there's been a lot of coverage of the incest in the media and obviously on Facebook. And again, I see lots of people going, oh, you know, those horny b-. And I'm like, you know, it's not necessarily about the horniness. It's not about needing the sex. It's about needing the power. And it's about needing to know that you can exert your agency over someone else's consent or lack of consent. And that those moments when you feel disrespected, when you have been the victim of sexual harassment, for example, are because you were robbed of your ability to assert your own agency and someone else robbed you of that. And it is about power. It's not about sex.
And just going on that, you know, we have to talk about the men here, I'm afraid. You know, we can't. It's a lot of, well, some people who have criticized this campaign, only, and women themselves, feminists themselves, saying, why do I, as a woman, have to go and, you know, go through, you know, out myself and, you know, go relive all these painful experiences, you know, just to make people take notice. How did you feel about that, those sorts of comments?
I think they're perfectly valid. I don't think we need to be lighting ourselves on fire in public every single time. Absolutely not. I think those women that are saying that have every right to maintain their silence or maintain their stance. I think it's a very strong point, which is not to say that because they have that right to stay silent, that the whole campaign is invalidated. People should have the right to speak out on their stories as well as keep that stuff to themselves as a matter of privacy or dignity or principles or whatever. As for the men, you know, as for the men, I think a lot of people were asking for the men to speak up to say, me too for themselves. Of course, if they were also victims of sexual harassment, to say me too, but also to say me too, I saw someone sexually harass someone else and not say anything, or I have sexually harassed someone and I did not know at the time, or I knew at the time but, you know, felt guilty later or something like that. Like, where are those stories of the people on the other side, the people who are robbing others of their agency? And I think it's going to be a lot harder to make those people talk ever.
I guess we should be somewhat comforted, maybe, that there are now those hashtags emerging. I can't remember now what they are.
I'm not technically or something.
I was that guy.
Those haven't stuck as well.
But they clearly haven't stuck as well, because who wants to admit their guilt? And also, once you admit that is an admission of guilt, and then, you know, there are
different
legal ramifications that can come out of that, which
I also don't know how I would feel. Say, like, if I was a victim of sexual harassment and my harasser went and used the hashtag Me Too, I harassed people and now I've repented. You know, I think there's so...
But you don't get to just walk away from this.
I think the power dynamics come into play there again. If you are the victim versus the harasser, if the harasser then takes the quote-unquote moral high road and admits to their guilt, does that absolve them? And does that mean that I, as a victim, am now no longer a victim, or that I have, you know, my experience has somehow been healed, you know? So I think, you know, I saw a lot of men jump on the bandwagon of supporting women, and that's always nice. But there's also this form of, like, skepticism of, okay, you're using this hashtag, you're saying, I support my sisters in feminism, I'm an ally, I support the women in my life. And I think, but I've heard stories about you. I've heard rumors about you, or I've seen you do something, and that's not coming up in the conversation. So there is this skepticism, and yeah, it goes back to the anger as well of, I don't feel like I can trust anyone. I don't know how to contend with that. I think I'm still struggling with that. I'm trying not to approach these stories with skepticism, but I have to say that the tone shifts for me when it comes from men.
Well, that's exactly what I was... I mean, for me, personally, at least, I tangle with this a lot, with that last part of what feels like a cycle, right? So you know, something begins, you know, and then you get sort of this critical mass of women saying, me too, me too, me too, people realizing that, and that gaining the credibility that it should have had from the very beginning, from even one person saying it, never mind millions. But then there's that last quarter where the men get involved, and they have to get involved. I mean, they have to get involved. And so you have that last quarter where you have maybe people, you know, feminists who are men saying, well, yes, this is wrong. Or you have men who say, I did this and I'm sorry. And I agree with you, Shah, completely that it's so, why is the onus on me now to forgive you?
Yeah.
Or is the onus on women to forgive you? But at the same time, having said that, there's that last very difficult, very tangled bit where there has to be some form of resolution, if not for the men, then for the women. If not for the women, then at least for the issue. You know, there has to be some form of, if not closure, because of course this will go on and on and on. I don't think, you know, Me Too is going to magically end sexual harassment by 2020. You know, nothing's going to happen by 2020, but that's an aside. But I do think that there is this last part of how we speak to one another, how men who feel, hey, I know it's not our job to help them go from feeling confronted by our anger to thinking, is there a reason for this anger, to realizing, huh, I am the reason for that anger, and then going through the motions of trying to make that better. I know it's not our job to help them get there. Yeah. But at the same time, if we rely on people who are constantly feeling attacked, constantly feeling confronted, to face their own demons collectively as a group, generally speaking, people who have not been great at confronting their own emotions, I don't know where that takes us, you know. So it's always going to stop at anger. And I think that's the big thing for me. I'm not tired of feeling angry because I don't have that privilege. I can't stop being angry. But at the same time, it can't keep going, because you're just meeting against this wall of toxic masculinity going, I think that's kind of your problem if you feel harassed. And it has to, there has to be some sort of softening on either side.
One would hope there was some kind of men's movement that could support their own members through this kind of emotional labor and self-realization and self-awareness. One would hope that they could do that for themselves.
And instead, that movement exists but is more toxic than anything that you could get. Well, so it's just a difficult thing.
Organizations. I think, but there has to be a way, as you say, there has to be a way for feminists to accept the allyship of men who wish to be allies. And because otherwise, where are we going? There is no forward.
And the thing is, like most movements, our allies are probably going to be deeply problematic. You've not seen a movement happen where every single person who was involved with it was, you know, a shining knight. There's always going to be people who say, well, yes, I support this, but only because I have daughters and mothers and sisters. There are always going to be those people. And do we reject their allyship? Do we take on the burden of education, which they may not receive very well? There are all these questions, but I think that as you grow into a movement, increasingly those are the questions you need to contend with beyond awareness, because it has to close off somewhere. There has to be forward motion. If not, it's always going to stop at feminists going, we're really angry, and men going, but why? And that's just going to go on.
Yeah, I guess you also need to unpack the whole concept of allyship. I think some people expect allyship to mean membership. So then it's like, oh, I support your issue, so therefore I can insert myself into the issue, or I can take over the issue. I have that right now, the same as you who has had direct experience with the issue. I think something to say to allies would be that you can take on this mantle without expecting something from other people. You can say, yes, because I have daughters, because I have mothers, whatever, that I now want to care about this cause. Okay, that's your story. That's fine. But how are you going to care about the cause? Are you only going to care about people who are your daughter and your mother? Are you only going to care about people who are mothers or something like that? So I think people,
but I think the same onus also lies on women. Mm-hmm. How are we going to care about this cause?
Yeah, absolutely.
What actually are we going to do?
Yeah.
I mean, you can put the hashtag on and you can all feel very good about yourselves, but at the end of the day,
I think the culture of silence is definitely pervasive in that, like, I've known so many different women go through harassment issues, not as victims, but as witnesses. Mm-hmm. And we've felt compelled in some way to keep quiet for whoever's benefit. Mm. But usually it's, because we feel unsafe. To your point earlier, Bilkis, about these powerful women in Hollywood who have had to keep silent for so long, where is their power? So maybe if we brought our power together, I think that's something the hashtag, the campaign has brought forward, this kind of whisper network kind of surfaced into the larger public arena.
Yeah, exactly. That whisper network, which was always there, wasn't it? You know, women would kind of warn each other, oh, don't go near him, don't go near that guy. But now it's come to the front. But again, you know, how do we take that, you know, and you know, it's like you said, you know, you feel good about yourself, you put the hashtag. So what should we as women do to you know, take it forward? Not just, you know, putting it on social media, yeah, this happened to me. What would you think would be a good outcome of that, you know, taking it from online to offline?
I think I'd like to see a dismantling of, well, take them all down. But beyond, you know, beyond that, I for me, the issue has always been sexual harassment is a huge issue, but it exists within the larger bubble of toxic masculinity, which I know I go on and on about, but it's so pervasive and you see it in the reactions and you see it in how people behave all the time. And I mentioned women earlier, and that's because in my circle of acquaintance, I've met women who felt unattractive because they weren't harassed. And who say things like, you know, and so when other women complain about harassment, they've taken it, and this is explicit. This isn't even implicit. I'm not reading into the situation. They have said explicitly, you know, stop showing off.
Oh, wow.
And I know this is the equivalent of I have a black friend, but I have, I've known, you know, about 2 to 3 separate occasions of like, of having this conversation of, and of having to explain, no, you know, no. And but the thing is that these women, not to blame them, but these women are the feedback loop that men are getting when they say, hey, that was a compliment. Yeah. Why can't you take a compliment? And so I just would love, and I don't know how to begin to do this. I would want to participate in a conversation about that, but I need to do it with people smarter than me. But I'd like to see that dismantling of all the things that prop up the behaviors, because that's the problem. I mean, so when men say, I've known women who think it's a compliment, what are you going to say? I've known women who think it was a compliment too. I'm not about to sit here and say, yeah, no, your truth is not the truth. It is. I've experienced that. But then you have to explain to both why that's problematic, which is to say, it's not a compliment. In no world is it a compliment. So those are the kinds of things. I know I'm. It sounds vague, but I just would like to see those types of things being torn away, particularly in the people who are growing up now, you know, this generation of 6-year-old boys, 12-year-old boys, 18-year-old teenagers. You know, I'd like to see it start there, not dismissing the 40-year-olds as lost causes, just that it would be nice to see that built in young.
Yeah.
On all sides, on every which side. I don't just mean to make it about the men. It's also to educate women that, hey, you live for yourself. You know, you do these things for yourself. If you look nice, if you would like to do that, if that makes you feel good, that should be its own reward. You don't kind of walk out and then some random construction worker, not to make it a cliche, but some random construction worker hoots at you and you go, I did good today. And I think, you know, it's that feedback loop is part of the problem.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess I'd like to talk about how the Me Too hashtag is not just about making men aware of how pervasive and systemic sexual harassment is, but also to make women really front up to it too. I have a number of friends who don't think of themselves as feminists, and they don't because they don't believe in the patriarchy. They don't believe that there is a systemic, widespread, global oppression of women. And I think one of the things that Me Too does is to show that the patriarchy really does exist, that it is so absolutely widespread that we can't start thinking that, you know, when it happens, it's an outlier. This is the norm. And this is what proves that patriarchy exists. So if this is what it takes to convince women that they should be feminists, then perhaps it has also done some good.
I think something that people can take from the Me Too campaign is to then look at your most immediate network. If this problem of the scale of the problem is too large to comprehend, localize it as much as possible. We all are talking about our friendship groups. Yeah. We all are possibly part of different workplaces or, you know, places of education or whatever. And I think it's trying to look at how we support people in the future. Has someone come to me and told me a story that now I realize is sexual harassment, and have I dismissed that? Can I not do that in the future? If I am part of a tight-knit friend group, maybe we can have a conversation one day about what our protocol is when it comes to this. Do we have kind of almost an emergency response? If I'm part of a workplace, is there kind of a code of conduct? And if I'm in a position of power in any way to influence that, maybe I can use that privilege to be like, do we have something in place? Can I front this to the people in charge? Can I push for something? Can we draft something? I think goes back also to the issue, sorry, not the issue, but like the concept of having a vocabulary and language. If we start having these conversations, we should continue to have them, and we should continue to have them in as many places as possible, in as many different ways as possible.
And, you know, I just want to go back to what Lynn said, you know, about it, well, the patriarchy as it is, right? And you know how this is also a moment to kind of connect the dots, you know, like you said, why didn't they speak up? Because they were afraid. I'm talking about the actresses, of course. Why didn't they speak up? Because they were in a position of less power. So it goes down to, you know, women not having equal pay, you know, even right down to things about birth control and just all the different ways that women are being oppressed. And, you know, like you said, your friends don't recognize the right, Bill, because you're saying that your friends don't see the patriarchy. Do you think this will kind of, you know, open up their eyes to such a thing?
Yes, and maybe it will also help to normalize again the idea of being a feminist, which certainly in this country is still incredibly demonized.
Yeah.
Mostly because people, I feel, don't recognize how wide a net feminism can throw, that you can support, like, you can believe that girls should go to school, and in some way that just makes you a feminist. That there is an enormous continuum within feminism itself. So I feel that by normalizing, again, the vocabulary around these conversations, then perhaps we can, it can achieve some change.
Yeah, I guess because also, you know, if women are in a position of power, you know, an authority, they will stop, you know, the submission of other women. They can, you know, so that men can't corner these other women and force them into sexual acts, or, you know, because they won't need the financial stability, the economic security and those sorts of things.
I think there's also the issue of, again, to go back to that idea of victimization, where harassers act victimized by a hashtag, you know, as opposed to actually laying a hand on someone else and people saying things like, oh, why are you attacking us? Why are you attacking us? I think a hashtag like this, if nothing else, is a good reminder that we should all question ourselves. Self-interrogation should just be a part of being a modern person, being a modern intellectual, being a modern, you know, a person who
citizen
is
citizen of the world.
Pretty much, yes. Someone who is a part of the world. You should always be asking yourself whether, I'm not asking you to live in self-doubt constantly. I think I'm just saying, why don't we reevaluate our values every so often? You know, just a moment like Me Too, I think, is a good opportunity for women who don't consider themselves feminists to say why, perhaps. Women who do consider themselves feminists to, you know, pretty much feel tormented over whether or not to join a hashtag. But, you know, and then, but that's also a good opportunity to ask ourselves, why do we feel that way? What are the circumstances that have made us feel that way? Is it me? Is it the world? If it's the world, what do I do? If it's me, what do I do? And for hopefully people who have harassed, or who think they might have, or who know people who have, and that is every single one of us, to sit down and ask themselves, was that harassment? If it, what are the parameters? Google is your friend. Your friends are your friends. Ask women, you know, just talk. It's if nothing else, every time you say a Me Too, every time you see a Me Too, it might be a good opportunity to just do a quick check-in with yourself and go, did I do that right? Have I done what I could? How do I feel? Why do I feel this way? It's an uncomfortable conversation to have with yourself, but if you can't have it with yourself, you're not going to have it with anybody else. And then feminists will one day just self-combust out of anger, and then half the women in the world will be gone, and that will be that.
Okay.
So that seems like a good point to end.
Yeah.
Rage.
All right. Okay. All right. So, I mean, you know, hopefully this remarkable show of solidarity, and I do think it is remarkable, you know, will really be a turning point for all of this. I mean, we've seen, like, for example, in the UK, I think people are drawing up industry codes of conduct, like you mentioned earlier. You know, so there is action happening in small pockets, and I guess it's important for all of us to continue that conversation, not just online but offline as well. All right, thank you so much, ladies, for joining me today. I've been speaking to Shah S. Aliyah, Bilkis Hijaz, and Lee Trilin, all three feminists, and we've been discussing the Me Too campaign. This has been Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.